Let's put a song so you can sing along with a special guest or two.
Or two.
You like to sing and dance, and this podcast, by chance, explores musicals for you. Theme Song, yeah!
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Life's But a Song, a podcast that likes to live in the land of musicals. I'm your host, John, and with me today are two very special guests. One pitched this to me, and the other one, well, it's his child. It's Phil Ginley and Joe Zasso, everyone. Woo!
Hello, hello.
Hello,
happy
everyone.
To be here.
Hi there.
And we're here today to talk about, okay, spoiler alert, Joe is the one that this is his baby. Did it come out in 1989 or 1990? I'm seeing two different things.
It premiered in 1989, November 17th, 1989. But
okay.
1990 is when it came out on VHS.
All right. So we're going to go with the 89 because that's when the world premiere happened. The 1989 film, It's Only a Movie. The screenplay is by Joseph Zasso and V.C. Siegfried. Am I saying that name correct? Great.
That's correct.
Music and lyrics by Timothy Frey, directed by Joseph Zasso, and according to IMDb, a film crew is shooting a murder mystery in a haunted house when the members of the cast and crew start turning up dead. So, Phil is the one that brought this to my attention.
Yes.
But I kind of want to start, Joe, with you, because, okay, it's so campy, I loved it. I do have a lot of questions about like the behind the scenes stuff though. I just want to start at the beginning. How did you be inspired to write this?
Back in the 80s, when I first began my journey, I was making a lot of direct to video movies, you know, my teen years, and I had been making horror films like I still do now, and you know, Creepshow remake, you know, Creepshow wannabes, you know, murder mysteries. And then one day, I had also fallen in love with musicals at that time, like Little Shop of Horrors and Phantom of the Paradise and Rocky Horror, all that stuff. And somebody, I think it was one of the actresses from It's Only a Movie, who said to me, you know, you should do a musical next. And somehow it just said, all right. And then meanwhile, this no budget, you know, everything's on video, doing it the absolute, you know, 99-cent store way. And somehow I thought, I guess when you're young and crazy, you know, let's do it. And I had this idea at the time. I had ideas for like demonic possession, like movies like Demons. It was like these Italian horror movies combined with a few other ideas of my own. And it just came about. I had this concept for a film crew making a movie in the house and everybody gets possessed by the devil. You know, why not? So, and I told the guy who wrote the music for my movie, Tim Fry, you know, he wrote the music for my three films before this. I said, can you write a musical? He said, yeah. Okay. So it was kind of just like, you know, it's not something I'm sure that, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber didn't do it this way, but that's what I did.
And Phil, how did you hear of this movie? Because I've never heard of this before you pitched it to me.
Yeah. So I have very, some would say fascinating taste. Like I try to find like really the most like underground. There was a period, especially in COVID, where I was really into shot on video horror films. For those who don't know, it's a period from essentially like during the VHS era when like consumer grade equipment was finally kind of being like provided to, you know, regular people just like you and me. And people were just, you know, making movies with their friends. And a lot of these movies were just kind of like made under the radar, occasionally put in video stores, maybe were rented, maybe were watched, but it wasn't really kind of like truly kicked up until a lot of these movies were like put on online where anyone could essentially watch them. And so I got into like this style of horror through like German splatter, Olaf Inbach, which is very like Dead Alive adjacent, campy 80s horror. And through that, I discovered Scream Book 1 or 2, which were directed by Joe Zasso. I believe he uploaded them during like COVID time, during the pandemic, when everyone was just kind of watching stuff on YouTube. that's where I discovered these movies. I really had a nice, I love the kind of chaotic, campy, very Long Island specific energy from these movies. And from there, I watched It's Only a Movie and then Maligno after that. So I am pretty well versed in Joe Zazzo's teen filmography so far. And yeah, I think this is like my, I think Scream Book 2, I think, is still my favorite out of everything he's done, but It's Only a Movie has such like Rocky horror, crazy, like I mean, like, and you kind of when you realize when you watch this that like making a musical movie is so much work, especially if you're making this, you know, just like on your own without any real like professional musicians. Like there is so much. I remember thinking about like when I was in college. I think I probably talked about this with you a couple times, John, when we did the Haunted House, like making like a musical movie like as a student film. I can't even imagine what that would be like in SUNY Fredonia, like with like the audio equipment that we have. Like there is such like even like when I watch like go to like super small film festivals, like you see a lot of like super indie movie musicals. Like they're so hard to make. And like just even to get like the syncing right of like the audio with the visuals, like that's something that like a lot of filmmakers don't really need to think about, but you have to be super cognizant when you're making a musical. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's kind of long answer for that question, but
because I don't know if everyone in this movie is like a theater girly or has like a musical background, but I have to give all of you kudos, the fact that you did it, especially in like a time before like you did it in the 80s. So there wasn't like today's technology where you can m make like the filters a little cooler or like have CGI or whatever. Like the makeup done was bananas in the best way possible. And then like I kept calling him the Harbinger. I don't remember almost anybody's names in this, I'm not gonna lie to you, but the old guy, it looked like his wig kept changing every scene he was in.
It probably was shifting for all we knew. We just kind of like, you know, we're like, go on location, just grab the wig, put the wig on. Okay. It's like,
No, wait,
come,
now
you
you
know,
have to be
there
Bosco.
was no
Take the wig
last move. It
off.
was just, you know. And
It
I think with like shot on video aesthetics, I think, you know, a lot of like VHS imagery has taken a lot of big like resurgence. You know, there's been a lot of like, you know, craving for analog media in like the world of kind of overconsumption and, you know, TikTokification of just media. And I think just, you know, kind of like seeing like very like fuzzy like imagery, there's like a certain kind of quality and like value to it. The footage of the haunted house itself, which I don't even know, like, do you remember where it was on location, Joe? But just like the very like blue, Well, the, well,
like
the,
almost
the
like
exterior,
infrared.
the well, the inside was some like it was like some kind of a lodge, but the outside was a place that I would get to know very well. It was actually D. Seversky Center on Long Island, where I shot a whole feature of Five Dead and the Crimson Canvas, but also it was used for things like Arthur, you know, with Liza Minnelli, and it also it's owned by New York Tech now. I've been to weddings there, so but little did I know it would represent my future. But we just used, I just filmed the outside of it, but the inside was like a million other places, you know, people's houses, you know, but and it was like freeze frame, you know, you
There
couldn't tell that, you know.
was one corridor that I was just like, this feels like a funeral home. Just
It was actually a catering hall. I think it was the new Hyde Park Inn, and that they let us, this is back in the day, they just let you film, no insurance, no nothing. Everybody knew but each other, and we filmed it on the lower level on a Saturday morning, and you had people screaming, making noise. And one of the managers came down and said, they're having a funeral luncheon upstairs. Could you keep it down just a little bit? I mean, that, you know,
No.
that was long before 9/11, before all those things where you could just film anywhere, no questions asked. No insurance. It didn't matter. You're trustworthy. And somehow we did it. One scene that at the end of the movie takes place in front of a theater, which is the Franklin Square Movie Theater. We just literally asked them,
R.I.P.
hi, could we film something in your theater? And I think the Fabulous Baker Boys was premiering that night, so there was a line of people I remember. And but they let us plug in. They didn't care who are we. Just said we're students. Okay. That's not anymore.
So I grew up on
That
Long
scene at
Island.
the end, all
I was gonna say I grew up on Long Island, but I grew up more in Suffolk County, in Selden area, but it honestly, when you open up and it's the Long Island Railroad, I was just like, huh, the trains haven't changed in like over 30 years.
The stations have changed. Yeah, definitely. They've upgraded them so greatly. But yeah, that was New Hyde Park train station, I think.
But then
we get the marquee of Herrick's Cinema too, which I'm pretty sure is another theater.
Now it's a Dollar Tree, I think, something like that.
Yep.
You can see the letters are falling off. So it was, you know, really on its way out.
So were you all like a troupe? Like, were you in like an acting class together, or how did you cast this?
I was a part of the New Hyde Park Players, which I'm very proud to be a part of. And to this day, we still have our luncheons once a year. And most of the people in this group are in their 80s and 90s. So I feel this absolute, you know, dedication to go to those luncheons in New Hyde Park every year. And I had performance. I cannot sing or dance to save my life. I have size 15 flat feet. And just read the Variety review if it's only a movie. I display the worst singing voice. I harmonize. But I did a lot of plays with them, a lot of, you know, comedies and, you know, Annie and, you know, Oklahoma, all that kind of stuff. But I call it the Pepper Pot Playhouse, basically. And these people, you know, were involved in it. You know, I knew them. They were in my other movies. You know, I had gotten to know them through various sources. And, you know, that's, nobody got paid. You know, there was no proper catering. They let us borrow their houses. And it was done weeknights, you know, while people have regular jobs, you know, I was in college. And, you know, it was just fun, you know, because everybody saw it as just that. And it wasn't, you know, it was tiring, but also it wasn't too much, you know.
Yeah, like everyone, it felt like everyone was in agreement that they knew what movie they were in. Like they all knew this was kind of a parody, kind of a comedy. Mm-hmm. Like they're all like, yeah, that's a little crazy. However, whenever I'm gonna try my best with her last name, Patty Komornik.
Yes. She's my Beverly Garland, as I like to call her. She was the star of all my movies in the 80s.
When she and Mara McKenney were on screen together, I was just, it was electric. And I wish, did you make a movie just starring the two of them, just bitching at each other the whole time?
I didn't even know what cat fights or those things were back then. I didn't realize I was actually doing it. You know, it was like the big, maybe because I think I had seen movies like Evil Under the Sun, you know, like, you know, the whole dynamic, or like, you know, A Mirror Cracked, you know, the whole, you know, bitchy. Whatever you want to call it, and you know, they work well together. Yeah,
and see, I was seeing
God, characters.
I was seeing another musical, MAME, where
yes.
It's MAME and Vera are like catty friends like that, but these two obviously are rivals, and it was just like I was just like, can we just like have them be the rest of the give them a movie?
Some of them, you know, it's funny how Patty, you know, I you know, hear from her to this day, but Mara, she was interesting. She was in a bunch of shows. She was a mail carrier at the time, and also an actress, you know, but the thing was, she just kind of disappeared. I can't find these people on anywhere. You know, like, they could have died. They could change their name. God only knows. But I wish I could track her down, but she was so legendary, you know?
Like, she had a very severe look to her. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't tell if she was well aware of like herself, or she was actually like being a character, and like the hair and everything and the wardrobe styling was helping her. But oh my God, like is her name Linella, the character?
Linolea.
Linolea.
Somebody said linoleum, so I just said, oh, Linolea. I just because these weird years.
I'm looking on the IMDb of it, and it says Linella. And I was like, sure, let's go with that.
I'm famous for my strange names, like Linolea Vanderbilt, or, you know.
I was like, he wrote that because of the Vanderbilts, right? Like the Vanderbilt Museum and all that.
I just probably saw it on a wall somewhere in the book. That's a friend of mine did the same thing. He wrote somebody's name is Maxell. And I was like, because he was looking at the cassette tape.
That's so, genius.
Know, sometimes you just do that, you know. It's like, oh God. But one character's name was Galligan. And I remember I used to have the poster for Gremlins on my wall. And it said Zach Galligan. So I just, you know, you never know where these things come from. You're looking, or know, you flip open the cookbook and then you find, you know, Veal Prince Orloff, like they did, you know.
The beauty of daydreaming, yeah.
This movie, it was just so funny and, like, campy. And, you know, I wanted to make sure before we started this, like, I asked Phil, being like, this is supposed to be funny, yes? Because there was I did an episode not that long ago where I came at it one way and everyone else came at it another way. So I was just like, making sure we're on the same page. I am supposed to laugh at this movie. I am supposed to laugh with this movie. Okay, great.
I saw that in the thread, you know, I said, yeah. You know, there isn't much you can say that is offensive.
I don't know you. Like, Phil knows you better than I do. So I was just like, I don't want to insult this guy and be like, oh my God, he made a piece of shit movie, when it's not a piece of shit movie. It's actually, like, pretty smart and funny. The only thing I'm going to ding is the audio quality, but I think that's just because of the camera and the technology.
The state of the times.
Yeah, because
the movie actually I ended up releasing originally in black and white. And if you look at it's on Blu-ray now, and they have the black and white version. And the reason is because the colors are all over the place. I mean, there was no color correction, so some scenes look gray and some scenes look colorful and some look green. And so that's what I just did that. At least that's how I fixed the, you know, the picture quality. But as far as the sound, you know, I had a microphone, you know, on a long cord plugged into a 3/4-inch video recorder, which was not portable. They sold it to me for a song, but it weighed like 300 pounds. And we didn't have boom mics. I just did it that way. I would hide it behind a plant. That's why sounds are kind of going to one side and sometimes the other, like singing in the rain kind of a thing. You turn your head away and the voice goes away. You know, it's like that kind of a thing. Or, you know, you're pulling on your necklace and it goes.
And I have to say, the songs are just so kitschy and fun. And there was one, though, that used, because on the IMDb page, unfortunately, there is no soundtrack listing. And that's why I was like, can somebody please send this to me? Because I don't, I like to, like, when I'm watching, I'll take some notes and write random thoughts and everything while the songs were happening. But I feel like there's one that I don't know when it happens or if it's mashed with another song. Hellfire? When is that?
That was a warning song from Mad Men, Millennial Man. That got cut from the movie. I decided to cut it because it was so badly out of sync. I mean, I kept it for the premiere, but I said, no, this gotta go. Because, and, you know, it's because it was just like, you know, the lips are going this way. And it was beyond Japanese, you know, badly dubbed movie. You know, it wasn't really necessary. So it was just a guy singing with flames around him. And, you know, it really didn't, you know, as a song, it's okay, but yeah, this doesn't. If you want to hear it, I'll send it to you. But yeah, it wasn't necessary.
So is that why at the end he has flames around him when the reverend sings?
Yeah, I kept that part. Yeah,
okay.
That was the only part of it that was. Yeah, I guess, you know, I figured that.
Because during that song, I was just like, wait, why is he in hell? What did he do?
Because I ended the movie and I learned on the spot how to do the two knobs, you know, the old-fashioned way, not this, you know, nowadays anything's possible, but that's what I learned, so I was able to edit. But for some reason that scene, I think I kept that just because I knew I was going to use it for the end, but I just decided just cut the whole number. I guess any good musical has to have a number cut.
Of course. So this way, when you release the soundtrack, you can be like, ooh, this isn't in the movie, everyone.
It's a deep cut, yeah.
They were going to release an LP of this. A Terror Vision, that's the one who released the Blu-ray. They actually were seriously considering, yeah, they release other albums. I think it was a matter of, because they couldn't get it done in time, but I was like, you want to make an album of this? It's like,
I want that Pennsylvania theme song, like, played across every interstate. Like, I want, like, Sufjan Stevens to get a hold of this Pennsylvania song, because he did that, like, state project, like, album thing, like, 20 years ago with, like, Illinois, Michigan, and whatnot. But, like, yeah, like, I just, the whole concept of, like, writing a song about how much you love a specific state, just such a fun quirk to me, you know. Like, I think, like, yeah, just like the first time I ever went to Pennsylvania as a Long Islander, I was like, this place is so weird and fascinating compared to where I'm from. Like, and I think like this that like song and dance, almost like Rocky Horror style from like the butler and the
Right.
maid, like feels very much kind of like, you know, like Long Islanders entering a new weird
Like Brad
place
and
that
Janet or
they have
something
no
in them.
idea. Yeah, very, it's very Brad and Janet. Yeah.
It's weird. The composer Tim Fry is from Pennsylvania. So he I guess he had to get his state in there. To this day, if I
Oh.
have to spell the word
You
Pennsylvania, I
got
literally have
it.
to pause and go PENNSYLVANIA. I have to remember through the song. That's how I remember. Otherwise, I'll screw
It's like
it up.
Oklahoma, you know?
Right.
I have to sing it every time I write it out.
Right.
But they,
Well, can you do the harmony? Can you do the,
so Higgins and Stefania?
Stefania. Yeah.
Stefania, they were supposed to be the riffraff and magenta.
Basically, yeah, they just,
Okay.
I remember
Because.
the actor who played Higgins was the only one that I think in the production that kind of didn't know what he was in for, and he was like kind of like the whole time. So that, and it his character is very basically that, just groan, 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 groan. That's
But it
so
works.
wherever he is, you did a good job, but yeah, groan back
It
at you.
worked because it also gave like a Lurch from Addams Family vibe as well. And okay, I have to ask this. Brian Dixon and Kathy Dixon, are they actually siblings?
They're actually a husband and wife.
They're husband and wife. Okay, great.
Yeah. And
Okay.
that's not her real hair. She has a curly hair, but yeah, she had like a wig on.
Well, because I was watching it and one of Brian's characters, Madman Malone, says that he is like the sibling
They were
of.
specifically gone film. Yeah,
Yeah, so I was
it's
just like,
complicated. Yeah,
I looked it up and I went, well, they have the same last name. So it's one or the other at this point. Unless they both randomly have the same last name, but they're not related in any way, shape, or form.
a common name. But yeah, they were all in the same theater company, so everybody just in fact, in one scene at the end of the movie where they have the big finale, you'll notice that Stefania is standing next to Higgins and the head is cut off. That's because it's me filling in because the actor couldn't make it. And this is a scene where she's on the floor on top of me and you just see legs kicking. That's me because the actor couldn't make it. So, so
It's
that's not too unusual, but.
it feels like you get you had him make some compromises as well throughout the filming of this. And but like, was this the vision you had when you wrote the script?
Much, yeah, because a lot of it just many things just came about as we went along. But I think it was just I had all these different ideas because I had been absorbing so many music. I had just seen Sweet Charity on Broadway with Debbie Allen, all the and I remember hearing The Rhythm of Life. I had never heard that song before, and that kind of inspired the finale along with Mean Green Mother from Outer Space. Like, all these things were blending in my head. And I still
Yes.
wanted to do something with demonic possession, so it's like, all right, well, it's gonna. I honestly think the second half of It's Only a Movie represents me more because it's more my style, and then the first half is more V.C. Siegfried's, humor and dialogue and such. So I mean, I basically wrote the story and made the outline, but that's why I say the first half is more him, and the second half is more me.
Okay. Yeah. Where you mean like everything before the house is
Right,
more
correct. Like setting
VC.
up the characters, the lot, I guess the banter, The
more or
Harlequin
less.
romance. Yeah, exactly. A lot of that, like some of the dialogue about, it just like minor dialogue along the way. I mean, I created the characters, but he kind of fleshed them out, and then I just kind of, all the craziness is mine.
I also may have missed like the detail that the book that they are turning into the movie was a murder mystery, because I thought it was like a smutty Cinderella story.
Actually,
Oh no, it's a Harlequin.
romance novel that bombed, and we figured, okay, well, the only way to make a success is to make a movie out of the bomb. I guess maybe because at the time, I heard, like things like The Lonely Lady, like those kind of movies. I kept thinking, you know what? If they made a better movie out of a bad book, so that's I maybe that was a weird mentality I had. That was their
I guess like
idea.
the modern comparison would be like Colleen Hoover film adaptations. So like it ends with us, or for example, I think it'd be
Okay.
like Spicy Book Talk has taken like a fun resurgence. So it's kind of like 80s Harlequin romances, you have Flowers in the Attic,
I think is like big real world comparison. And yeah, because it kind of goes back to like those like soccer moms, like Long Island housewives doing like book clubs, and like, so it's kind of like a weird resurgence, which is coming back now in book talk and
the
those
beach
communities
read
there.
Of yeah, it all, exactly. Right? Like a
yes.
Take it on vacation, you read it, and it'll take you a day to read the whole book. Because I mean, it said it in the summer IMDb summary that it's a murder mystery. So I was like, when was this supposed
some
to?
People misinterpret, like, well, they got Linolia wrong, so you know. But it's also the idea, like, even like with Broadway shows, like Ragtime and Xanadu were bombs of a movies, but they became hit musicals. Mm-hmm. So maybe, like, maybe that's, I guess, what these characters are figuring. Like, we'll make a hit movie out of a bomb book. But
I don't know what you're talking about. Xanadu is the best movie ever, Joe.
I love.
Actually,
or even think about the producers, how they like wanted to make like a flop.
Yeah,
right. It turned into a major hit.
Well, so
I like
this,
my dad.
This was giving a vibe of another movie that Phil said that they wanted to do as an episode, which is called Voyage of the Rock Aliens. I've done that twice on this podcast. It's amazing.
Golden movie.
If you've never seen that movie, I would say watch it. And then
I must. Now everybody's telling
Joe,
me.
It's so good.
It's so good. It's giving like a similar feel to it of it's only a movie. Where there's a camp factor. I mean, this wasn't intended to be a musical from the jump. It just became one.
No, actually, it was meant to be. I had ideas, you know, the germ of the idea, and then the musical came from that.
Okay,
is when somebody actually said, "Why not make a musical?" And I just said, "All right." And I said, "Well, I've got this idea. If we made a musical from this, this could work." And I think for the most part it did. Depends how you look at it.
John, I'm glad you brought up Voyage of the Rock Aliens too, because like the song 21st Century by Rema is such like weird new wave Devo coded, and I feel like a lot of the instrumentation and musicality in It's Only a Movie has like a very similar like weird Devo, like especially the Pennsylvania song has a lot of like very like angular guitars and kind of like that like very like quirky, you know, like David Elfman before he made like film compositions, like when he was doing Ongo Boingo, Forbidden Zone, which is also like a Danny Elfman, I think, is another point of comparison here. Yeah, but I feel like Voyage of the Rock Aliens is also a good kind of like mirror film to It's Only Movie, because it's very much like these different like genres of camp. You know, you have like the quirky new wave space stuff, and then you have, you know, Jeremy Jackson and Pia Sidora doing this very like glittery schmaltzy pop song, and you kind of have that in It's Only a Movie too, where you have very like weird like rock musical style, and at the end is very like gospel influenced, almost like Little Shop of Horrors with the like backup singers as well.
Right,
there's a lot of like play of change of like different genres and styles kind of like all getting kind of like swirled together in a weird stew.
Well, where do we go next? Like, you can tell that this was like a passion project, but like in a good way, not like in a, oh, this is a pet. Like, you know, what was that movie that came out? The Francis Ford Coppola movie that came out not that long ago. That
Megalopolis.
He was working on that for like 40 years, and you can tell. But this one, like, it feels like you and VC came together and you were like, let's write a movie. And I mean, do you remember how long it took you to film it?
It was started shooting in January of 89 for 1 week. And then it was just like a week here, you know, like throughout and into the summer. And it premiered in November, but really a chunk of it was shot in January of 89 and, you know, little pieces here and there. And I just remember lugging this ginormous 3/4-inch video recorder everywhere. It was like, it was ludicrous, you know. But that's because, you know, I got it for almost nothing, and you know, well, you get what you pay for, and including a hernia. But I remember it was winter when we were shooting, and it was summer, it was humid, it was raining at one point, you know. I had to put an umbrella over the thing. It was just, you know, that was passion. I don't know if it's madness or passion, but those were the energy forces behind it.
So is there a cult following around this? Like,
I didn't think there was until Terrorvision asked me, you know, they want to release my 80s movies, which I had buried for the longest time because they're all shot, you know, they were shot on VHS, many of them, and you know, you can't see, you can't hear, you can't, you know. And I'm just laughing because I didn't think anybody would want to see this. It's like it's during COVID, you know, Tim Fry had said to me, oh, you know, I have the MP4s of these if you want. And I upload them just for fun. And a couple of years later, this label says, hey, we'd like to release them. I'm like, why? and sure enough, you know, they're, I think 30 or 40 years makes a difference because then the world yes. sees things a whole different way. They may see it as some sort of alternative universe art of some sort because it's just such a product of its time. Even the way it was made is such a product of its time. And it's not so much the quality mm-hmm. of the story or the acting. It's just, you know, it's like the way we do things now is so the AI and everything else. I mean, it's so completely different. There were no cell phones back then. There was no internet back then. You know, I don't even think we had faxes really back then. So the way, how we did it, I don't know how we communicated. There's no Amazon, none of that stuff.
Yeah, Joe, I think the glory in your movies, and I think like shot on video film, shot on video horror in general, is that like, I think for me and John's generation, especially like generations younger than us, there's a lot of like Achilles heels and monkeys on our backs where it's like, oh, like I could make this thing, but what if no one likes it? Like, I think we get really stuck in our heads and just like very kind mm-hmm. of like paranoid about like the reactions of what we make, or almost like wanting permission to make stuff. And I think right. like, that's what's so invigorating about watching like 80s, like super indie micro set, like micro budget, no budget stuff, is that like you didn't get permission, you just made them. And I think there's such like yeah. a power yeah. in that where like we want like, you know, to get on Broadway, to get like in big film festivals like Sundance and like have our art be like recognized and validated, but you could just make it and then just see where it goes from there. And there's such a like power in that, that I think that like your generation doesn't really like fully realize, like compared to like, I think like our like insecurities and anxieties, there's such like a like universal kind of power. I think also just like such a versatility and resilience with like independent art and like, you know, not corporate funded art and like truly mm-hmm. like DIY art that like is appreciated like in long run. It just takes a very long time.
Because there's also, it could also go back to theater where like people would put on barn shows, you know, it's like, I have a barn, let's put on a show.
Yes.
You know, there's musicals based around that or shows actually based around that concept. So like the fact that you all just were like, I got a video camera, I have a week free in January, let's make a movie. Right? And then all of a sudden
that's
it's like.
That's all you had to do back then. You know, that's really before real life gets in the way and you start going, you know, your mind starts going 12 directions. But back then that was school and that. That's all I wanted, you know.
Because it's
great is that because yeah. I didn't have to answer to anyone. Like I just made the movies I wanted to make, and you know, they're very pure in that way. Even if they're completely deranged, but at least it's, you know, very, very pure, and nobody was stepping. Yes. I think It's Only Movie was the first time I ever collaborated with anybody. But the other ones, it was just me telling whatever I wanted to tell you.
Because it also seems very freeing, like with the rest of the cast. They're like, I'm just gonna make a strong choice, and because I want to, and I'm not being like overly directed, or you know, if I like the guy that played the director,
Lou
I don't
Barbera,
remember.
Yeah,
he had an accent. I don't know if that was the intent, but it seemed like he was like, I could do an accent. Let me do an accent. You know, there's something like just very pure about this genre. Like, you know, the fact that you made it yourself, it's truly independent, and it's like a bunch of friends coming together to create something. And it's a, like...
It's performance as play, less as work. Yes. I think is a good way to put it.
Yeah, and it's also very... it's fun, you know? Like, yeah, I was just having fun at some points watching it, and... There was a lot of times I was laughing at it. Like I said, when Linolia and Blossom were on screen, I was just ready with popcorn. Just like, yes, give me this bitch fight. You know, call each other old. Was Blossom wearing a wig?
Yeah. Yes, she was.
Okay. Okay. I just wanted to make sure because I was like, it's 89. So like, maybe it's her real hair.
It's funny you say there's one line in the movie that I would totally now take back because I didn't realize how toxic I was being. There was a joke between Linolia and Blossom. And she goes, my, it is a hot day. And the other one goes, are you sure it isn't menopause? And I learned much later in life, you know, all too well, I said, that is so misogynist, what you just said. You know, it's like you can't say jokes like that. You know, only people who have experienced menopause or are experiencing are the only ones that could joke. But later in life, I said, oh, my God, that was such a mean thing you said. You know,
honestly, it was so cunt. I didn't care because I think that's before or around that time. Blossom says, I'm 39. And I went, you're 39. Girl.
Or she likes to say plenty nine. Yeah. That she would always say that, you know, in real life.
I was just like, girl, are we looking at the same face here?
What's like, what if you ever seen The Fan with Lauren Bacall when she goes, from this day on, I'll be 45 forever. I'm like, really? You must be 45. This is like the 10th year in a row you're celebrating your 45th.
So when you were casting this, why did you cast yourself as Wally and VC cast himself as Miles?
VC was always supposed to be in it. There was another actor that was going to be, who I went to high school with, who was going to play Wally. And when I went to give him his schedule, he was like, oh, I work this day. I'm going, you told me you were available. It was just like one of those things where I threw my hands up in the air. So I just ended up, that's when I ended up playing the part. And, you know, now, I mean, I act more nowadays, but back then I just wanted to direct. And that's why I ended up playing the part, because this guy didn't understand, you know, when I said, when are you free? Doesn't mean, you know, when you feel like working. So that's how it came about.
But VC was always supposed to play.
He was always supposed to play, yeah.
The womanizing actor who rips out his underwear on command.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. The one who played Gloria, they got married during the movie, but they're husband and wife. They've been together for a long time.
One's Gloria?
You can tell whenever the sexy music comes on, that's when someone sexy is supposed to be on. It's like, oh, that sort of saxophone sound. You know?
Yeah, but is Gloria the one that he does the Romeo and Juliet scene with? Or yeah,
exactly.
Is she...
And then I crushed their heads together.
Okay. Because then there was the other one that had, I'm assuming it's a pink sweater, but she and the Harbinger have a scene in like the garage or something, and she's just
her name is Jill Casey. I think it's Jill Drum, I think now, but she she's the one with the, you know, the real Long Island accent. And she was in a bunch of my other movies, but I'm trying to remember her, you know, something. I'm trying to remember her character name. I remember her real name, but
Sarah McGuire.
Sarah, glad you can make it.
There's a couple, I mean, there are a couple characters that I just forgot their names, because that's just me and, you know, my sensibilities. But I'm like, okay, actor, secretary, you know? You're the director, you're the producer.
I had done a performance of Annie with, or, you know, like, or Music Man with, you know, just like a year or two before this. And I was like, hey, you want to be in a movie? In fact, the guy who played the minister at the end, when I was a teenager, I worked at Macy's in Roosevelt Field, and we were looking for somebody to play the minister. You know, I didn't do things like backstage and that stuff back then. So I just, there was one guy there, and he happened to be black. And I said, and he said he's with the church. I said, you want to be in a movie? That's basically how I would do it. You know, it's, and the gospelettes were girls I went to high school with. So I was like, oh, you know.
Because we were talking about...
I say of all the names, though, Blossom Butterworth is the one that definitely sticks out the most, like, the alliteration. Like there's, like, such, like, a silliness. Like, it almost... Blossom Butterworth sounds like a Harlequin Romance, like, character name from, and like, 1986.
And the fact she gets her own song is amazing.
Her big number.
And she's also the one that...
That's my favorite number of the whole movie.
Same.
I think she's also at the very end, like, she, like, I think my favorite gag in this movie where, like, she's getting interviewed by, like, the red carpet, and she just, like, whips out this entire, like scroll and, like, reads her, like, life story.
You're right. Like,
very, very actor brains thing to do.
She was one.
She's like that in real life, but she is a larger than life kind of. She was also a director of you know, high school plays. She was a singer. She was a ham. She was definitely a ham in real life. But she, larger than life personality, and just, you know, like I said, she was always like, she became like what I called my Beverly Garland. She was always like the leading lady that always, like, when she would scream 1950s style, like, she clutch her face.
Yes. Like that, yeah. Kind of, you know.
over the top, you know, completely. And like I said, I thank God for Facebook, and that's how we stay in touch with each other. And she's, you know, my goodness, everybody goes on. I told her when Blu-ray came out, I said, aren't people following you into the, you know, to the Piggly Wiggly, where it is you live in Virginia? And she said, no. I said, they better be.
Well, yeah, because to go back to the cult following of this, it felt like The Room in a way where, where I'm like, there has to be a following around this, because like sometimes it takes time for people to appreciate some movies, you know, some high camp movies like this one.
Like I said, 30 or 40 years, that's what happens. Not 10, not 20, but 30 or 40. That does the trick, it seems.
And then you describing, Joe, like the making of it, it reminded me of Miami Connection, which that one like was unearthed a few years ago as well. And it's from the 80s, and it's another one where it was filmed in... It was filmed in Orlando, even though it's called Miami Connection. And it's all like around Orlando. And they did a similar thing where it was like, can we film here for today? You know, or something like that. But Phil, you were telling me, isn't there like a screening that you are doing or you're hosting of this?
For It's Only a Movie? Yes.
Yeah.
It's going to be screening in June, part of Spectacles. Pride Month theme programming. For those who don't know, Spectacle Theater is a micro cinema. Existed, started in 2011, still going strong. It is right off the L stop at Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. So if you live in the New York City area, it is relatively easy to get to. $5 for admission, like only $5 for a movie, which is kind of, for New York, is kind of a deal breaker, I feel like, personally.
At that point, it's free.
Q&A with Joe. Yeah, basically, especially in New York. And we're planning to do Q&As with Joe on, let me just triple check the dates again, the 24th and the 25th. One of them will be for Maligno, which is his giallo, Dario Argento inspired film.
My favorite of my 80s movies.
And then the other one is It's Only a Movie, which is the one that we're talking about now.
Yeah.
I don't know which one will be, it'll be on the website there, the details as well. But
yeah, we can.
Yeah, but it's also available on YouTube. You could watch it. You could do screening parties of it, watch parties of it as many times as you like for whoever is listening.
Because, like, there are really laugh out loud moments in this. Like, I'm sure you all heard me laugh because I just watched this. I'm not going to lie. I hit end and I hit start the Zoom call, you know? So. It is really funny at points, and it like, and like, you know, you can get into like crossing the line of like overacting territory, but like that's the point of this movie, you know.
Yeah, it's exactly,
it's silly. And so like,
heightened,
are you
I call it heightened.
So Joe, do you do screenings around the world, or is it just like this is a newer thing for you?
The old stuff now, people like Spectacle are nice enough to invite us and all that. I would love to have more screenings. Anytime I have a new film, I tend to maybe put it in the festival. I go to Italy, they'll have a screening of something. You know, it's nice, but I was never at the habit of putting movies into festivals or even, I would love to have more screenings. It's just not, you know, I'm not sure who wants it or who has a theater that can offer it. You know, a lot of times I guess it depends if it fits into their, you know, their motif or it is, or their, you know, a lot of times people will want money from me to screen it, you know, so like it's, like comes down to that. But I would love to just do more of that just as a kind of a retro thing. Like a museum, things like that. I'm always up for that. So.
Yeah. Cause I feel there's something here. And I feel like everybody needs to see this. And like, I don't have a big following.
Especially on Long Island.
Yeah. Yes.
I think a lot of Long Islanders need to like, and I think also just like for like the inspiration of it all, of just realizing that like, you know, we have the technology now, like you could make like super campy stuff on your own with your friends. Like, and I'm sure it could probably be a bit more fun than just like trying to make like a TikTok reel that is, you know, you're just trying to make it go viral. Like instead of just, you know, like try to make silly stuff with your friends for the sake of it and see where comes from there.
It's see that TikTok, the only thing that makes me roll my eyes is that, I mean, people, because people will just take the camera and do whatever. I think of all that lugging, all those long hours and editing and this. People just pull out their phone, go bling bling, and now they're famous. Yeah, it's like, oh no, it doesn't happen that way. Oh no, 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 no.
Yeah,
no,
they just whip their phone out of their pocket, film it, and put it back, and then later upload it somewhere and edit it. Yeah,
that just makes my blood boil. It's like, absolutely not. One thing I will say, all the 80s, all the movies I did in the 80s, the one biggest skill I got from doing all these movies, is it taught me how to prepare for plan B, plan C, plan D in anything in life. Like if you start to sense something's not going to go right, like your train's not going to be on time or this isn't going to work, you know how to have, okay, let's get plan B in order so there are no problems. Because that's what all these movies taught me, is just how to prepare for any eventuality, you know? And
yeah,
so that's what, you know, that's the biggest thing I got from it. Not so much art, but definitely just that's my life lessons I got. But yeah, especially but nowadays when people just take out their phone and just go like this, it's like, I could strangle you. I'm sorry. It's like, get out of my face.
And also something should be said about like the fact that I'm not sure where you were in your career at the time you made this, but you made something for you and you were like, you were making the art, which I know a lot of people do struggle with, where they're like, I can't book jobs. There's nothing really out there for me. So the fact that like, this is a good example of like creating something, and I don't know if it was like you were in between gigs, or if you were like, I have nights free and I have a day job, so, but I want to still be creative.
I was graduating high school, and it was first year of college for its only movie. That was like between schools, more or less. You know?
So, you were creating something. So that's awesome. And
I guess I had half out of my mind. It's like, and there's nothing really 80s about this movie either. It's like, I mean, maybe the styles perhaps, but like none of it screams 1989. It just has almost like it's just like a weird kind of, homogenized kind of feel to it. It was like, I want to say it's timeless, but it doesn't really say 1989 either. You know?
Yeah.
Except for me, the big hairdos.
That's what I was going to say. Just besides like the clothing and style and the hairstyles, like there's nothing for the women, basically, like the men or whatever, but like the women with like the big shoulder pads and slicked hair.
Poofy hair. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody even uses terms like too totally tubular or awesome. Or like nothing that says 80s, you know?
No. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about before we get into Stripe and Flat?
What do I want to talk about? I'd like to talk about
Madeline. Do you have any? All right. Well, I like to ask people who are involved in some way, shape, or form, whatever we're talking about. And you've regaled us with some stories, but do you have like another fun story that you like to tell people about It's Only a Movie?
Yeah, let's see. A fun story. But aside from that thing with the funeral director, the funeral luncheon, them coming down and saying, keep it down because they're mourning upstairs, you know? Kind of, just the fact that I remember Blossom, her wigs kept changing. Every time she would turn, the wig would turn this way, or she would be singing more musical numbers. And she pose, all of a sudden the line was, I'm the object of your fascination. All of a sudden her blouse popped open. She went, oh, turn that camera off. like little things like that, you know.
There was
little mishaps, but no real, you know, real crazy things, but yeah, like little funny things like that.
There was a goof that was I don't know if you meant to keep it in the movie, but during It's a Lousy World After All, VC does pull her wig a little bit.
Yeah, that was, yeah, they kept that just for.
And I was like, how dare you? Don't touch our diva's wig.
Whacked, you know, we were just kind of like, you know, making our own rules as we went along. After a while, it was like, it wasn't very regimented.
All right, let's get into Shrep and Flat, shall we?
Yes.
Okay.
Sharp Flat.
So in this section, we're going to highlight some moments, whether or not we talked about it. If we liked it, it's sharp. And if we didn't like it or thought it could change, it's flat. Joe, I'm sad to report I do have a flat, but we did talk about it already. And my flat is like the audio quality, especially during the songs, where like I couldn't, at points, I couldn't make out sometimes what they were saying. I watch this on YouTube, and I usually watch things with captions, but YouTube captions are off sometimes, so I had to rely on the old ears here, but but there were
we
moments.
We need a sing-along version with, like, you know, like the, like, little, like right. Joe Zazzo's face, like, bouncing the lyric, yeah.
And I only...
He does have subtitles on the Blu-ray, but that's why I'm trying to get that for this upcoming screening. I'm trying to get just the right version, because so that you won't have to strain, you know, you'll be able to enjoy it in all its glory.
I think I noticed that more in Pennsylvania, because, what's her name? I want to... Kathy Dixon, she has a light voice, and the music was a little louder than her singing. So, again, it's not you, it's not the film really, it's just like the technology you had at the time. It's not really like the worst offense in the world, but I was just like, I can't really hear them. And like, there was a moment when they first got to the house that everyone was ADR'd. So I was like, obviously they had to go back and re-record things, because maybe that was during the luncheon. But I was just like, oh, I can't hear her. But that's really it. Like, the rest of it, like I said, it's funny. It's supposed to be campy and a B movie or whatever of the time. But Phil, let's start with you. Do you have any flats for It's Only a Movie?
So I'd say my only real flat, it isn't even any of the songs, I'd say. It's like, so I am like a weird crank about like Irish like leprechaun characters. Like, I think it's just a thing where I'm just kind of like, okay, that feels like, you know, low-hanging fruit. So that whole character, I feel like I was kind of like not crazy about. And spoiler alert, was kind of happy when he got his hand cut off.
And then went to hell.
He
lost a hand and gained an arm.
I'd say, like, also, like, the audio is a bit of a flat, but that's also, like, there's kind of, like, a, you know, like, that is kind of what you take with a lot of these, like, super DIY, like, shot-on-video productions. I would say also, like, with his other film that we're screening, Maligno, there's a whole scene where they film it outside and it's windy, so you can't hear anything. That's happening.
Oh yeah, thankfully doesn't
happen in this one. But I'd say, I mean, if we want, but I'd say the only real flat for me is the Irish character. I think also just like, you know, when you could tell an Irish accent's being done very like overdone. I can't even do the Irish accent, but it just like. I remember, like, when I watched, like, I did, like, a DCOM dive back, like, during, like, pandemic era, and, like, during, like, Luck of the Irish, I was just like, oh, my God, this is making me see red the entire time. Oh, no offense to fans of Luck of the Irish. Yeah. You know. There we go, yeah.
Joe, I hate to even ask you this, but do you have any flats about It's Only a Movie?
Lots. Do I not have any
flats?
One critic wrote this and said it was a bloated mess of ideas. I think in many ways it was, because it just lacked focus. It was going all over the place. You know, it was trying to be this, it's trying to be this. And with different eyes and different ears, I would completely, you know, change things. But we were just doing, like I said, doing what came naturally, you know, what you thought worked, you know. And I mean, I'm a big fan of bad movie musicals, including stuff like The Apple, which to this day, I still love it to death. But even that was another one of those movies where they had ideas everywhere, you know, and none of them really gelled, but you watch it anyway. There's an energy behind it that makes you so. Yeah, there are flats all over the place, believe me. But I mean, I just think it's also a bit talky. I think a lot of people complain, even the shorter version is still too long, and that would have, you know, pulled it together a little tighter.
But there's a shorter version?
Like the beginning scenes were, you know, like a lot of chatting, getting to know people, I should have been moving a lot faster, but, you know, that was, I guess, the norm then. And nowadays, forget it. It's like, you know, there wouldn't be one shot that's more than a second, you know, the way if we redid it now.
I don't know. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah. In the Variety article, I think that Joe's mentioning as well, the writer uses this term. I think it's like strictly for consumers of low camp when describing it's only a movie. And I'm like, well, I'm a consumer of low camp and I love low camp. I take that as a compliment. That's actually like I use that as the title for the program that we're doing in June, like strictly for consumers of low camp to SOV genre benders from Joe Zazzo. Instead of gender benders, genre benders. I feel like it's a nice little spin.
The kitchen that of this is like sweet, you know, it's fun and
yeah,
you know, like I understood it. I do like kitschy what some may deem as bad movies, you know, like I've trolled a lot of the How Did This Get Made podcast by doing a lot of their movies that are musical based. So like I get it. I see it. I see the work though. Like it's not easy. And like I know Joe, you probably have like 30 years of memories or almost 40 years of memories based around this and this time period and everything. So like you have had time to sit and think it over, but like, honestly, there's not to me as a first time viewer of it, it wasn't bad. It was fun. And like, maybe for my liking, I would have liked a little more songs, but like, that's just me, you know, it's my own opinion of it. Like, yeah, I see what you mean when you're saying there's a lot of book scenes in between things.
I think that's like the good thing about like this era is that like because there is so much out there, people's tastes are so singular and different. Like I have like extremely weird, like I'm an M. Night Shyamalan apologist and I understand that that's probably a controversial thing to say for some people.
Yes, it is.
But you know, like we all have different, you know, like it's the whole like one man's trash is another man's treasure concept. Yeah. Like I think like there is a lot of value to be had in things that some people don't find value in. And I think like that's not like it's not like an affront to like whatever you're into. I think it's just speaks to the like vast amount of media that's like out there today currently.
Nowadays, especially, man, I used to think when this movie was first made, you know, there was so many people that just were like, what the hell is this? Because they weren't used to so much of it. But I'd realized as years passed, there's so many consumers of low camp, so to speak, all over the world, you know, and that people that like things are far stranger than I could ever imagine. And yet, you know, that's yep. why they when they dig it now, it's like, I see now why they might, but it's like, but yeah, people were just kind of playing hot potato. When I tried to get this thing released, I was sending screeners out to, you know, like Prism Video, all these, you know, video companies and, you know, reject. I can understand now. Back then I was like, you know, shattering, but you know, but I can understand their point. This isn't something that's an easy, it isn't an easy sell for a lot of people, especially if you like musicals. You know, unless you like really weird musicals, most people aren't going to like it. If you like comedies, if you like horror, you know, they're going to say, yeah, but there's songs with it. You know, it's not like, for example, something like Little Shop of Horrors where it has an even balance of everything.
Yeah.
One of my favorite musicals of all time, Phantom of the Paradise. I mean, that was trash when it first came out. Now it's deemed brilliant, you know, but people just back
that's
then,
right.
they didn't know what to make of it because they said, it's sadistic, it's weird, it's too dark. It's too silly. So, you know,
kind of Paul Williams is an evil guy. No one was ready right. to see Paul Williams, like, as a misogynist.
And like,
they didn't know how to market it either because people thought it was a spoof and they went in there and said, this is kind of nasty, you know, but they didn't, you know, so, but they loved it in Europe. So I guess that says it.
and like I said, like, there is an audience out there for this. So I'm waiting for it to, like, become the next Phantom of the Paradise, Apple, Rocky Horror, Shock Treatment, you know, all those ones that weren't appreciated of their time, but audiences grew to appreciate it. Which leads us into Sharps. So I first sharped that secretary who threatens with the spotlight incident and like the...
Pre-show, I love her.
All those bits are really funny, yeah.
Like, but she... All of them are great, but she was the one that I was just like, you've got something here. Like, there's a lot of people in this that I don't know them at all, but I'm like, you're doing something. And I really, and it's not like taught. That is talent, you know, like to be that funny, but not like wear a clown nose and a pinwheel hat. You know, you have to be able to let the material, because there wasn't improvising in this movie, right? Like everything
pretty
was scripted.
No, if there was, it was like, you know, very, very, you know, minor. Like more, I would say the more like acting choices than improv. But yeah, not really.
Yeah, because you could tell that everything was scripted, so there wasn't a lot of like, you know, like Kristen Wiig or Will Ferrell level of like improvising a scene.
Yeah, exactly. That like Curb Your Enthusiasm or something like that, where they just let, you know, get an idea and they just have some banter made from that. You know, no, nothing like that.
Which kind of leads into my next sharp. It's, I think it's during Future Universe Pictures or right before that, when you cut back to Judy like mugging to the camera. You know, she's making a face but not saying anything. And you and the other guy are just talking about her book, and she's just, it's like a split second of her reaction.
I think it might have been, that might have just been an edit. I think I had to cover something or something like that. Maybe that's why I grabbed that shot.
I loved it. It was because I was just like, whoa, we're just cutting back to her for a hot second. Cool. Obviously, I'm sharping Patty. Can you remind
Komornik?
Patty Komornik and Mara McKenna. Like I said, I want a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern version of this movie, but just the two of them.
There's a new sitcom. You know,
yes.
I just hope that the drag queens make a Blossom costume for Halloween.
You know what?
That means that this musical has arrived.
Then, yes. You know, when
I mean, if Ant, the one from Weapons, if they can make an Ant, you know, Amy Madigan, I forget the character name already.
Aunt Gladys.
Yeah, if they could do that, you know, they could do this.
And then my, I mean, I sharped those actors. I also sharped their dialogue. So that's a sharp for you, Joe, because you wrote the dialogue. So like them bitch fighting and sniping at each other. So funny. Such a huge sharp. And then my last sharp is, again, for Linolia. Just like her in the bedroom talking to nobody, but I was just sitting there like, she's delivering a Shakespearean level monologue to nobody about acting exercises. And I'm just like, I need more of you in my life.
Now I must stretch, you know.
Now I must stretch my tongue. And now I must stretch my tongue the other way.
I'm stretched enough.
And like, I'm pretty sure
today is the rest of the day of your life, you know.
And I'm pretty sure the hair is doing a lot of like the acting for me, but like, she's amazing.
I think it's, but we have Moose back then. I think Moose was still a new thing. I don't even think it's in anymore, but yeah, that was it was Moose crazy.
Oh my
back
God.
Then back when I had hair, I had Moose.
Yeah, where I'm not gonna lie, I was just like looking at the cast list being like, which one is Wally? And then you say your name and I went, oh, he's very 80s, right? 80s. Yeah. 30 years, 40 80s, years ago. Yeah.
Very 18. You know, still at it.
But Phil, what were your sharps?
So, I mean, I already mentioned this previously, but I'd say the Pennsylvania song, big sharp for me. Love any music about, you know, states of the United States America. Love that. I also mentioned this a little bit, but like the big sharp for me is like the outside, like deep fried exteriors of the haunted house, like the weird blue ghostly effect it has. It just looks so cool and weird to me. And just also like the effect at the end where they have like, Joe, you have like the weird like orange star that kind of like rotates. It's like a weird,
I was playing with their video effects and I said, oh, this works. Okay, this works. Just, like,
that was amazing. It has, like, certain,
it looks like so like
long,
I mean, like
CGI.
it's like this works. Proto like digital aesthetic that like I'm really into. I'm also, I'd say I'm also sharpening the last song Give Us the Good Word Now. You know, I'm a big Little Shop of Horrors fan. Like, I think it definitely really like harkens to that like a girl group style. What else do I want to sharp?
I was honestly expecting the entire gospel choir to come in and by the power of their voices to save everyone in the house. I mean, that kind of did happen, but it wasn't the entire group.
Yeah, we come back. Well, it's funny. That was a happy accident. We one of the people in the cast knew a priest who was part of a parish in Harlem, and again, it was like, oh, you want to film something there? We filmed, they were only too happy to do it. They were thrilled. They were in the movie, and they all came to the premiere. They're all decked out, you know. But it was one of those things where, I mean, that part was not in the script, and then we said, why not? You know, and one night we decided, let's all go to Harlem. Let's all go, you know. And they were gracious and kind, you know.
That's amazing.
You know, but some things just happened by accident. And I was like, okay. I think it was such a crazy, you know, grab bag of things. We just, anything we did because it worked.
Any other Sharpsville?
I'd say I'm also going to sharp the scene where the author is like checking herself in the mirror and she sees like the ghoulish version of herself. You know, one of my favorite things about Zazzle's movies is just like screaming that people do, just like deranged, like yelling. Also like a lot of the like cinematography of like characters just like looking directly into the camera reminds me so much of Peep Show. Like there's kind of like a really like deadpan energy to a lot of the comedy here that I like. So I'm going to give that a sharp too.
Hey.
All right, Joe, it's your turn. What are your sharps?
My sharps. I like Blossom. I thought, you know, her character, I think that was one. And when I think of the movie, that's one of the first things I think of. Definitely. I like the second half because that represents a lot of the horror that I would do eventually, like any of the demonic possession, you know, any of that stuff. And the other, and pretty much all of the musical numbers I enjoyed the most. I mean, I like Blossom the best, but I'm pleased with the musical numbers and all. So in that respect, those are the sharps.
You're not going to sharp yourself? I'm going to sharp you then. I'm going to sharp Joseph Zazzo in this.
It's funny. I think my acting's okay in it, but it didn't, you know, it just kind of was, I think I was whiny and my voice was very high in it, you know.
Bit of you doing the suicidal ideation, like after the rip, like yeah. In the first musical number, yeah, like that I thought was very funny.
Yeah, what like, was yeah, what? I, like I was like, that's an extreme.
I don't know. I don't think I thought of that. I think maybe BC thought of that. We were just you know trying to find you know just things to do in shots because it really was no proper choreography. A lot you can see a lot of it was so free form. It was just kind of like okay.
It's a very trauma joke.
Correct.
I think trauma movie jokes. Yeah.
Yeah,
pretty much. You're right.
I don't know if you've seen Toxic Avenger the musical. There's a stage version of Toxic Avenger, and
I
it was
I heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah, this was giving a lot of those vibes as well. You know, where it's like it feels like you're parodying another movie, but it's an original movie that you're making. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, it did.
So funny. Okay, so last question. Would you add any of the songs to your life's playlist? And by this, I mean, like, you're doing the dishes or you're on a road trip, you know, you're not watching the movie, but you have the imaginary soundtrack to what, as of this recording, it's imaginary soundtrack, but hopefully by the time, at some point, there is a real one. What songs would you listen to? I really only wrote down Blossom Butterworth because it was so funny.
Blossom and the one Magic in the Shadows. Those are the two I like the best. And the rest, yeah, okay, but those two stick out. You know,
Magic in the Shadows, actually, yes. Because that's the one that Adrienne Marie Corso.
The production scene, you know? That's what we call it, that, if you want to call it.
Well, I did like Adrienne's voice in that song. I was like, oh, where was she
singing? It wasn't her real voice. Believe it or not, the voice was done by Karen Komornik, Patty's daughter, who is a singer and also does musical theater. She's the star of Maligno, this other movie we're going to be showing. But Adrienne is a dancer. She choreographed the production, but she's not a singer. So it's a movie. We're going to do a little Marnie Nixon. So, you know, we got some Karen.
Bollywood style. Yeah.
Okay.
So there
okay.
we go. Yeah, who to know? You didn't even know this.
I
mean, that's what a lot of Bollywood movies do too. Like
you fooled me. Yeah, I thought it was her. But because I was just like, where's her singing the whole movie in this musical? You know,
Right.
now it makes
I didn't know
sense.
you could. She didn't.
Actually, I do have one more question specific to it's only a movie. So, Joe, you said earlier it was supposed to be in black and white. Was there a cut of that? Is that available anywhere?
It is. It's on the Blu-ray. It was always it premiered in color, and then when I went to release it on VHS, I decided to shut the colors off. You know, when they went to make the dupes of it, because I said, you know, it was bothering me. But when they release it on Blu-ray, they have it as an extra. They have it like a, you know, also watch the black and white version. It's the same movie. It's just in black and white. If you turn the color off on your TV set, it'll be black and white. So there you go. That's basically all. There was no special treatment of it. They just, you know, turned off the color.
I think that might be interesting to watch because, you know, a lot of the times the green filter was just a little too distracting, but it would, it might. Yeah. If I had, like, thank you so graciously, Joe, for offering to send me a Blu-ray copy. But I was like, that's funny. I would need a Blu-ray player in order to appreciate
it. But a lot of people have them. I'm surprised how many don't. I mean, you know, I guess it's.
I feel like I need to invest in one now to watch the black and white version of It's Only a Movie.
Right? It's mostly people who have like PS4s or PS3s because that's like built in. Like that's at least I still have Blu-rays, yeah. Because I don't even think laptops have like disk drives now anymore,
no.
Which is so frustrating.
No, they don't. They
you have to like
VHS.
You have to like get a USB.
I mean, cassettes are also
right.
and filmed cameras, you know, like camera rolls are being
with actual film. They just, you know, bring it to get developed, you know, the old fashioned way. Turntables are back again. You know, it's like, I think, and even like audio tapes there's some distributors that release movie soundtracks on old fashioned audio tapes and people still have players, yeah. You know, it gives you that. It gives you that nostalgic feel more than anything else, I think. But a lot of people feel that vinyl sounds better than CDs. I've always heard this.
Because everything
I think the big thing for,
old
I'm
is
going back,
new again. Ah.
I was going to say that. But like, I've been getting back into CDs just because like I want to listen to music on my commutes, but I also don't want to be like tethered to my phone. Because I feel like if I'm listening to music, I'm always going to be like, you know, scrolling through Instagram or whatever. Whereas like, you know, let me put my phone away and listen to music and just focus on the music. And I think like a lot of people are really learning to do that again, where it's like learning to like, you know, like appreciate the media they consume without being kind of consumed in the overconsumption of our current age or what have you.
All right. Well, I'm calling it. We're done with the episode. We did It's Only a Movie. Ooh. Woo! From
Yay.
1989. For real this time. Ha ha. But what do you all have to plug or promote? Let's start with Phil.
Yes. So I will plug Spectacle Theater, which is what we'll where we'll be playing these two movies. Let me give you the exact address just so is on 124th South 3rd Street, Brooklyn, New York, between Bedford Avenue and Berry Street. They play movies every single day on weekdays, 7:30 and 10 p.m. On the weekends, usually do 3 p.m., 5 p.m., 7:30, 10 p.m., and then midnights. All screenings are $5 each. I am doing a retrospective on a Canadian filmmaker next month, Bill Mason. But in June, we're going to be doing Joe Zazzo's two movies, the one that we just mentioned, It's Only a Movie, and his Giallo-inspired film, Maligno. They will both be screening in June. And the two Q&As will be June 24th and June 25th, both 7:30 respectfully. You could follow Spectacle Theater at Spectacle NYC on Instagram. You could also follow me at Avant Emoji on Instagram as well for all of my, you know, like I do some film writing. I have a piece coming out next month for Filmies. But yeah.
Joe, what do you have to plug or promote?
Plugging besides the spectacles thing, there's something that is done in July for a dear friend of mine. It's on Long Island. It's called the Sci-Fi Minicon. It is to support the Nassau County Cerebral Palsy Association. And a lot of my movie friends like Catherine Mary Stewart, Elizabeth Shepherd from Damien Omen 2, tarot writer Sasha Grimm, they come down as guests, you know, but it's done in the Levittown Fire Hall, even though it's in Hicksville, go figure. But that's done the third Saturday of July, and it's this big, you know, thing they do, which is it for charity, and it brings in lots of friends and fun and, you know, cosplay, and, you know, it's done for charity.
Is it off the Hempstead Turnpike in Levittown?
It's off Old Country Road. Okay. It's off Old Country Road. It's just by Westbury. It's right near Hicksville, but it's like in the, you know, little section of it. But they you know, bring out the DeLoreans, all those cars from Back to the Future, the Knight Rider cars. It's fun. It's all done for charity, and kids enjoy
it.
But
the
they
same
bring in
where. I'm going into very specific Long Island lore here. Is this in the same lot where United States of America is? Is that still a thing?
Yeah,
even
Martin,
United States?
I don't recall.
Do you know
I just know
John?
That it's.
I don't know what that where that is, but
I think it's Levittown Parkway. It's called. It's just this like side thing. But anyway, but that's and so look that up. And Sci-Fi Mini-Con's call. You can meet Catherine Mary Stewart. Kayla Brady from Days of Our Lives.
I'm going to have to take and, off and talk to Catherine Mary Stewart about the apple.
Oh, yes. She just did Steel Magnolias down in Kentucky. So she's always doing something. It's amazing. Now she's going to be there to help with this tarot ghost story stuff too. So yeah, it's fun. And I have several movies coming out this year on Blu-ray later this year. And I can't give the names away, but I'll just say there's about 7 or 8 of them. So be on the lookout.
Do you have a website or Instagram or something where people can find this information?
Jozazo.net. That's JOEZASO.net. And I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram. You can come find me.
Just Joe Zazzo on Instagram?
On Instagram, it's under Cafe Himbo. That's my one of my aliases. I do cookbooks and with horror celebrities, but it's called Cafe Himbo because they used to call me a horror himbo. So came up with the name. God, I've been doing it for like...
I think that's actually what like... Well, like, but that term was like got me into your because, like, that was like that term himbo is having like a moment, I think. And I was like, wait, there's a himbo filmmaker? Oh, I need to get into this. Absolutely.
There could be scream queens, there could be horror himbos, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, man.
One of those things that was just done as a joke and it became a brand. It became like a character I play now. It's like, to the point where people don't even know my real name. They just know me as Cafe Himbo, you know?
And if you want to, I don't know, if you, the listener, want to talk more about It's Only a Movie, or you know what? I'm going to make a call to action that I don't know if anybody's actually going to respond. If you created a musical movie that you want to talk about on the podcast, I mean, let me know. Obviously, I'm open to any content here.
I'll keep doing my research, John.
Great. You can email me at buttersongpod@gmail.com. Also on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube at buttersongpod. Yeah, I may go to the thing in both events that you two plugged because it sounds very fascinating and I need a life. And if you want to be part of the next episode's conversation, well, we'll be talking about something completely different and we'll be discussing Flower Drum Song, the movie.
Ooh, okay.
So, Joe, Phil, thank you so much for coming on. I mean, honestly, you're more than welcome to come back on and not just plug things you've made.
Thank you.
So
thank you, John.
You're like a special guest. You're like Elkie Summer would go on Johnny Carson for no reason. You know?
What'd you say, Phil?
Because I saw you did RRR, but like you haven't done a lot of other Bollywood.
No, not yet. Films, that, right? That's a whole untapped market. I know.
I could speak on some of them. I can email you about that.
We will talk off air about that. Yeah. And Joe, again, thank you so much. And if you want to talk about a musical movie, you have my email now.
He has a lot of like film encyclopedic knowledge. So yeah,
we'll get
like
Catherine Joe, if you come talk about the apple, she'd probably love to do it.
We'll talk afterwards about that. But anyway, yes. Everyone, thank you for listening and bye for now.
Special thanks to Aaron Troy for creating the pod's artwork and to Nick Bombacino for composing the theme song and the jingles. A huge thank you to CastBox for hosting this podcast. And thank you again for tuning in to today's episode of Life's But a Song. Bye for now, everyone, and have a musical day.